I go, I'm Kay, and you're not from the old Saturday Night Live stuff. Okay, my name's Kay. I'm a compulsive overeater, and we're going to give you your state the. English is just going to be hard. I just know tonight. It's very hard. Sherry talked about qualifying. So, yeah, I don't know. Because the only day that matters in your abstinence is today. But the last time I binged was February 14th, 1984. That was the day of my last binge. That was Valentine's Day. And I looked in the mirror. And, you know, after your binge, you're ugly. It's just ugly. Just emotionally, physically, spiritually, it's ugly. And you know, I kind of started to berate myself, as usual. And I went, you know, I just looked in the mirror, and I don't know where this came from. And went, I love you too much to do this to you anymore, kid. And that only came because I had been coming to meetings. I'd been in for about a year and a half. And I kept trying my way to get abstinence, to understand it, because in my family, knowledge is a big deal. You figure it out. You don't really ask questions. You should just have the knowledge. But I figured out that I really didn't know and that I couldn't bully or berate or use my brain to get recovery. And I have never beat myself into submission. So... you know, I mean, that was a long time ago, but I remember that day. I remember that day. I'm in the bathroom in my first apartment here in Omaha, and I just remember that. And I don't ever want to forget how bad I felt. I don't ever want to forget how physically painful binging is, you know, because sometimes I think it's not a big deal, and it's like the last time I put the last time I physically hurt from ingesting something, it was water. And I'm already off this. I was going to try so hard to stay on it. my ex-husband had just started a job that was going to take him away on Saturday nights. Now, my life had never been alone on Saturday nights before. I made sure that I was not alone on Saturday nights, so I was going to be alone, married on Saturday nights. You can't do a whole lot because you can't go out partying like I used to. And that is one of the reasons I started the old Saturday night meeting was so I had something to do on Saturday night. But this was the week before that meeting was going to start, and I drank so much fluid. I just drank water. Just water. Not pop. Just water. Just water. Go in the kitchen. Look around. Get a glass of water. Just go out. Just, you know. And all of a sudden I went, I'm in physical pain. I'm in physical pain from all the water I drink. It's like, it's still oral gratification, but your body can only go through water so fast. I'm like, God, I forgot how much binging hurts. This just hurt. You know, I mean, there's the slow, you know, moral degrading, but there's just that physical pain that I just forgotten about. So I don't ever want to forget the physical pain. I don't ever want to forget the spiritual devastation. And I don't ever want to forget the night that I came like this close to committing suicide. Just, it was a direct link to the program that I didn't. And some of the family stuff is my mom is a very shrewd woman on how to manipulate doctors with getting prescription pills. I always wonder why the doctor was like her best friend, you know. That's why, because she was manipulating him. And back in the day, people didn't really realize what was happening, you know. You know, think about prescription pill poppers and stuff. And my dad was my foodie buddy. He was my foodie buddy. And he had his stash of candy, you know, that I would raid. But you can't raid it too much, because, of course, a foodie's going to know how much food's there, you know. So, and some of it was pretty skunky, because it's not like... You know, how we let stuff rot and we just don't throw it away. We'll eat it someday. Okay, that's my dad and me. And my brother was a very, very gifted, very talented, brilliant alcoholic. Really absolute tortured genius. Really, the older I get, the more I look back and I'm like, yeah, he was brilliant and a genius and such a tortured soul. And my sister is... literally my best friend. She has various addictions, and she is in recovery. My brother got in recovery, too. And my sister is And when I go home to stuff and my family's just being crazy, I just can kind of look at my sister and go, yeah, it's crazy. It's just, we just look at each other like, yeah, this is crazy. This isn't normal. And we just go forward because that's just the way my family is. It's not like we're going to change the dynamics in my family, but she and I are like our safe cornerstone for each other. And I mean, my family does put the fun in dysfunctional. It really is. But it is dysfunctional. My dad is just eats sugar all the time. He is not morbidly obese. My dad is 90 years old. He has had a set of 6 bypasses, 5 bypasses, a pacemaker, a stent, has lost his teeth directly due to the massive amounts of sugar that he eats, because not he didn't brush his teeth, but he had caps, you know, to make them pretty. Well, when you pack that much sugar in, you can't even brush them all away, and he's lost his teeth, and it's hard for him to eat, so he just literally eats frozen sugar all the time. I mean, the Schwann's man, we're putting out $60 a week. This is up in South Dakota, $60 a week to the Schwann's brand, and we're not buying steak. You know, it's like, over the freezer, I'm like, I am so glad I'm not newly in recovery, because this would be really hard. And my dad says, okay, do you want some, like, whatever? Cool. No, Dad. Noticed I haven't eaten sugar in the last XYZ years? Oh. Okay. So I'm like, okay. And when I was little, I really was little. I mean, I was a little kid. And people would comment that I was, and my mom is a healthy eater, so we didn't have crap in our house. It's one thing that had really helped my recovery, because my mom never taught me, oh, you don't feel good here, eat something. My mom taught me, oh, you don't feel anything. No, you don't feel that way. That's what my mom taught me. I got the food part of my own. Oh, you don't feel that way. But she was a healthy, so there was not crap for me to eat. I mean, I remember I went to a friend's house one night, and I learned about taking snacks after school. We didn't do that in our house. I went to someone else and found mixing these various foods together, and I'm like, this is heaven! This is great! And I lived in a very ethnic Scandinavian neighborhood. I was raised on a farm, so I couldn't just go down to the quick food place because it's 5 miles in the country. But I'd go up to my neighbors, and they have all this. Here, you want some? And I'm like, yes, thank you. And I would just sit there and just clean the plate. And they go, well, such a little thing. You sure eat a lot. And I'm like, yeah, I won't just get this stuff until the next time I come here. I know I couldn't have been more than 10. Someone said about comment me being little. And I remember thinking this, but you don't understand. Once I start to eat, there will be no stopping it. That is not a normal thought for a 10-year-old little girl. And I can remember where I was when I thought that in this one part of the school. You don't understand. Once I start, I will never stop. And then, you know, we packed lunches in this one-room country schoolhouse I went to, and so that was healthy. You know, and I just longed for the days when the other kids would have birthdays because their mother would bring this crap in. I'd always serve, because you always get more when you serve. And then I went to high school, and they had the cafeteria lunches, and people would complain about them. I'm like, how can you complain about fats and starches? What is wrong with you people? They would just pass me down their plates, you know, and I'm not like, the fats and starch isn't the alpha and the omega for me, but you know, if it was there, I was eating it. So then I had to start dieting. You know, I was eating all this food. And so my eating would be a big salad after school. And you guys don't have this. It's called Western dressing. But it's just pretty much like sugar. It's just pretty much, you know, like, usually most salad dressings, it's like one or two. Oh, this was like first. You know, I put like a cup of that and a cup of lettuce. So, yeah, I wasn't real good at dieting. And I also, a very abnormal thought, very, very young, was I couldn't wait to get to the nursing home. I couldn't wait to be old and go to a nursing home, because they're always giving those old people crap. You know, we go visit my grandparents, and they were always, like, serving them. I'm like, God, I can't wait till I'm, you're going to love me, because some of you guys know how old I am. Well, I'm 65, and then I just go to the nursing home, and I can just eat this crap all the time. I couldn't wait. Not a normal thought. So step two was really easy for me, because I knew how crazy I was with this. And then, so then I'm in high school, I've gained some weight, so then I decided I'm going to go on my first official diet, and so I became anorexic, and I was pretty thin. Now, I look back in pictures, and I'm like, yeah, you were pretty thin. And anorexic really didn't work for me, because you think about food all the time, but you don't eat it. Now, that lasted the shortest of all my periods of eating disorder. Just no. You just think all the time, but you don't. So, anorexic wasn't going to work for me. And so then I just dieted up and down, up and down. Then I get off high school, and I go to college. I, of course, man, if you've all lived in dorms, they bring the crap home, back from home. So Sunday night, I was like, it was like Halloween, because I'd just go up and down the halls getting all the crap that people would bring back from. I'm going to listen to this and hear how many times I say crap. I've got to stop that. All the sweets that people would be bringing. And I just remember just eating that stuff so hard and like packing it in my teeth so it would be there for a while. You know, I knew I'd brush my teeth later, but I went in there, I'd be able to taste all that stuff. And then, you know, there's a lot of foodies that live in dorms, and they would just be cooking and eating all night long, and I was right there with them. I was their buddy in arms. I was just right there. I was splitting out seams. And I was wearing my mother's clothes in college, because I split out seams. So then I started dieting again. And so then now I'm a PE major in college, so I was pretty active, and you're running around. Well, I also discovered the beer diet. You drink enough beer, you don't do anything unless it just kind of washes everything out of your system. So I tried that diet for a while. And I don't ever bring fat pictures to stuff, because my fat pictures, you do not recognize me. You don't. There was a picture in my college annual. I did not know it was me until I really stared and looked at the stocking cap that I had on. I did not know it was me, because the first 5 pounds I get is straight to my face. And it's just, I just get so round. So it's like, I don't bring fat pictures, because I could take anybody's fat pictures and go, that's me, because it's just as unrecognizable as my own fat pictures. And usually most of my pictures were taken after I lost the weight. So there weren't too many fat pictures anyway. And but they were like after I'd been on another diet. And then, so then I get out of college. Then I discovered this lovely article, and most of you guys know this fact. This lovely article is an Ann Landers thing, and it talked about bulimia. It says that you could eat and throw up and not gain weight. Well, happy day. I've now discovered the promised land. Of course, I didn't read the bottom of the article that talks about absolutely devastating depressions. Absolutely horrendous depressions, because it just jacks your blood sugar up really bad. And I am hypoglycemic, so it was pretty much like taking all of my emotions and everything and just splatting them on a wall. Just up and down, up and down, up and down, up and down. So I would eat all the sugar, because I had to, and then I'd have to throw it up. And so, you know, you're jacked up from the sugar, and then you're down, and then you're up, and you're just, it's just awful. But I thought it worked for me. And of course, you'd start it out like just a little bit here and there, you know, and then it was just progressive. And another abnormal thought was, I was reading this article that Jane Fonda wrote, that she was I don't know if she's a recovering bulimic, but she's been a bulimic, and it talked about buying all this food and throwing it up all day. Now do I think, oh, poor Jane? I think, wow, to be rich and to buy the good stuff and then throw it up. Ooh, because it makes a difference there. But you don't have to buy the cheap stuff. You can buy the good stuff. Yeah, another lesson in insanity in that. So, So then I get out of college, and then I moved to Sioux City, and I lived a lifetime 1 year there. I was away from my friends. I was away from my family. I was in a job that I should not have been in. It was not a good job for me. I sucked. And they started finding it out, my bosses, and I tried to cover, and I was just, I was eating maple syrup on French fries at midnight. I remember that, thinking, this is really good, because I'd been drinking too. So mix that combination, you're all wired for sound, and you will do the best ever the next day at work. You'll really be at the top of your game then. So then I lost that weight, and because I thought, well, I don't want to be unemployed and depressed and fat. So I went for two out of three. And so then I kind of went around, went to school some more. And then it was kind of like I went into remission for a while. I've heard other people like, it wasn't like a big deal. And but this whole time I'm trying other fixes. I'm trying, man, trying them to fix me. My job was a good job, and my next job was a good job and had a big title, so that should have fixed me. It didn't. And had a really cool car. That didn't fix me. Nothing was fixing me. I wasn't doing good, but I wasn't eating because I had all this other stuff that I was trying to get a fix from. So that's all the way. And I know it's none of it's working. And then I did some geographic relocation. So I've tried men, geographical locations, varying my diet, beer. Well, it wasn't just beer. It's a lot of different alcohol, and I really like the sweet stuff too. Wasn't a big deal. If you give me like scotch, I'll nurse it all night, but if you give me some junk with sugar in it, I'll suck it right down. But so before, I couldn't stand to be alone. Before, I would do nothing but eat all the time. Before, I considered suicide on a daily basis and found great comfort in it, thinking of being dead. And I was always hungry. My two major emotions were hungry and confused. That was it. So that was kind of what I was like, in a way. Also, I'm also very, the word insane would probably much fit the best, because I was so hyper, I was so wired all the time. And by this time, I'm the fitness director of the Downtown Y, and so I'm teaching like three exercise classes a day and just bouncing off every freaking wall. And they had a medical scale there. It's nothing like a great compulsive overeater with a medical scale at her fingertips. Nothing like weighing yourself and changing your mood 3 to 4 times a day. You know, just, walked by that thing, and it called me as much as the food. So I tried being an exercise bulimic, but I figured I was going to have to pretty much run to New York on a daily basis, so that didn't work for me either. So, then I married an alcoholic, which was really a good thing, because 2 weeks after we were married, I took him to treatment. Most people drive them to drink. I drove mine to treatment, which got me into Al-Anon, which found my first OA sponsor. And, God has just dropped people on their heads in front of me. This lady I used to work with, she mentioned something about her alcoholic husband, and so that's led me to getting John in treatment. And then through the Al-Anon, this lady walked by, and I thought, I don't know who she is or what she has, but she has this, like, serenity thing. Well, she was also in OA, because I know enough about Al-Anon. There's some crazies in there, because I used to see how we used to eat after the meeting, so I know Al-Anon wasn't their own issue. And Jeannie was my first OA sponsor, and so... And back then, this was in the early 80s, you didn't talk about bulimia. You know, I had never mentioned a meeting, I was extra special, you know, and I had an extra layer of awfulness on me. And so then I screwed this up. It was not my OA four-step, it was my Al-Anon four-step. And we went through the four-step, and there was the part about gluttony, and I said, yeah, I've eaten so much I've thrown up. Well, all this other horrid thing about lying, cheating, stealing, a lot of dishonesty, a lot of stealing. So she goes, oh, so you're a liar and a thief. Yeah, but... She goes, why don't we just boil down to you're a liar and a thief? And I'm like, well, okay, mean lady. I'm never telling anything to again. And she said, so, you know, this throwing up thing. I go, yeah, da-da-da-da-da. And she said, I knew there was something with you. I knew you were a foodie, but you didn't look like a foodie at the time. I always talk food. Okay, now we're going to propel... And, you know, a lot of people burn their four steps, right? I didn't, because I never put that much work into anything in my entire life. I didn't care how many degrees I got, I never put that much work into anything. And so I kept it, and about, I had to be in recovery 4 or 5 years, and I read it, and I'm like, I thought I only mentioned food once. The whole thing was food, the obsession with food. I didn't even realize how obsessed I was with food until I wasn't obsessed anymore. You know, I just... Food. And I talked to Jeannie about this, and she goes, I knew you'd get there where you'd realize that. You know, she knew it right away. It was more than obvious, you know. But it was, I was just totally obsessed with food. So then we discovered about bulimia then. So then I'm in OA, and the first year, I back on the family issues of you just don't ask questions. You just go forward. You're just okay. You're just fine. My family is the definition of fine. And, you know, you don't... And they'd say, how do you feel? And I'm like, confused and hungry. What? Is there another range? Is there like another range in here? And they'd even... In fact, I was so bad that God made me work in a treatment center. He said, this kid needs intensive care. So I had to go work in a treatment center. And I'm not a therapist. I was in the recreation part of the therapy. And I would sit in group and I'm thinking... Is that how screwed up I sound to other people? Because he's out to teenagers, and I'm thinking, well, it's obvious what's wrong with them. Why can't they see it? And all of a sudden, I'm getting these messages. That's what other people, when your sponsor's trying to tell you that, that's how obvious you are to her. So then I started learning how to just shut up and absorb, because I was, when they would talk about for me to get inside of me, I was so terrified, and I couldn't figure out what I was absolutely terrified of. Absolutely terrified of. I just had this fear of, like, you know that book, Why Am I Afraid to Tell You Who I Am? We're going to get back to that book in a second. And it's like, all of a sudden I realized, I was sitting there, and I thought, because I'm afraid if I really open up, there will be nothing. There is nothing inside of me. I am a nothing. And that's not it. So when I finally kind of got this door cracked open to me, it's just me. It's not the big boogeyman. It's not something awful. There was a lot of stuff to clean up. A lot of that lying and thieving needed some severe cleaning up, you know? But it wasn't like I was this huge boogeyman of myself. And the program has taught me how to just like, and that horrid expression I used to hate was, you did the best you could at the time. I used to hate that expression. Hated it. It's like, how pathetic is that? I sucked. I didn't do the best I could. And all of a sudden one day I thought, with what I had, all of my prior experiences, not blaming it on my family, not blaming it on anything, with what I had up until that point, I did the best I could. If I wanted to do better, I was going to have to work this program, and I was going to have to go forward. But first I had to accept the fact that I did the best I could at the time before I could go forward. And that was really hard, just to accept myself, the mess that I was. And the first time they read the promises and they comprehend the word serenity and no peace, I'm like, yeah, right. No longer was to shut the door on the regret the past, and was to shut the door on it. That one I totally could not comprehend. I didn't. It was like, wah, 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 wah. I did not comprehend. I thought I had such a horrid person in the past that I judged myself so harshly for the stuff I did. And in fact, a couple of things I did in my past, I didn't tell my sponsor in the fourth step. I was also seeing a therapist, and I went and told her a couple of things because I figured I'd see her reaction if she was really shocked. you know, she was kind of surprised that I'd had, that I, that didn't look like this person that would do those kind of things, had done those. So I thought, well, I've already told someone that, so I didn't have to tell my sponsor that, but because I told somebody. But, you know, another little manipulation on the addict part. So anyway, so now the promises, it's like, yeah, I can sit here and go, no, I'm not serene all the time, but I can comprehend the word serenity, and I know peace. You know, I'm not terrified to be alone. I used to have to go to 7 meetings a week because I was so terrified of being alone. Because, oh, the first marriage didn't work out 1.5 years later, and all I thought of was, oh, my dad didn't get his money for his investment. Yeah, my family was real emotional. You know, the end of Gone with the Wind, when Scarlett goes, fiddle-dee-dee, I'll worry about it tomorrow. I had more friends call me the first time that was actually on TV, and she goes, well, Scarlett, how you doing? Because I didn't worry about anything. Fiddle-dee-dee, I'll worry about it tomorrow. I'll manage, manipulate my way all of this. And so in the financial thing, I couldn't understand never being afraid of money. I had to get so stone cold broke in this program to just go, I have food enough for today. I have paid my electric bill. I am good. Because I sat in a house in a really cold winter. My contractor had stolen money from me. So my coffee table was a pile of sheetrock. My walls were to the studs. I had a cement floor, and I got laid off, and I was going through divorce, and he took all the money on the way out. And I would just get overwhelmed, and I'm like, and I would get on my horse, and I would ride to the top of this hill, and I would think, just for this moment in time, everything is okay. And I'd think, well, I have my abstinence, that's all I need. And some days I'd think, well, you need more than that. And I'm thinking, nope. That's pretty much all I can manage, because one thing I learned in this program is I may not have anything on this earth. God can take away my marriage. He could have taken away my house. He has taken away jobs. But the only way you're going to get my abstinence is if I give it to you. It's my abstinence. And no one was going to be worth that. It was my abstinence. And that was some days the only thing I had to hang on to. You know, and I had piles of nails and sawdust, like in this corner. I'm like, well, today, maybe we could clean up that pile of sawdust and nails. Just that one. Don't have to clean up everything. And I would slowly go forward. But I had to start with, today, if the only thing I have is my abstinence, that's going to be good. It's just going to be okay. Because I knew without that, I knew if I gave in, then I would have nothing. If I started eating then, I'd still have a pile of sheetrock. You know, and I just could go forward. And I was several years in recovery with that, and it was still a challenge, and it was a good thing I'd gone to meeting after meeting after meeting. So I'd sit in my house in the country with no gas, and people would come out to get me, because I had friends in OA. They, we'll come get you, we'll take you to a movie. I go, you don't have to do that. And they go, no, we need to get you out of here. I was okay with being alone, so I didn't have to leave, but they knew I shouldn't stay there forever. So my friends came and got me, but I would sit there at home sometimes, and I would hear you guys. I would hear maybe a speaker I'd heard the week before saying, abstinence is first. You know, spirituality was where I get my abstinence. So that is technically first, but my abstinence, I got to go for that first. And it's the only thing I could hang on to. And I had to hang on to God to keep my abstinence. And I would be so angry, and he would go, I love my sister to death, but she always goes, it's okay, it's okay. I go, no, it's not okay. It sucks, okay? It truly sucks right now. But in the long run, ultimately, it will be okay. And I always had to look at that. I'm thinking, you know, my family's got a great sense of humor. I'm thinking, it's going to take about 5 years to be able to laugh at this one. And I was able to laugh at some of this stuff later on. And I would just cuddle up with my dogs, my cat, and it was like, okay, it's just okay. And I would hear the program in my head, and I would read literature, and I knew I would ultimately be okay. And I've since remarried to this really nice guy. To know him, we may argue, but since he's my height, we always see eye to eye. And there are some things that he does wrong, because I'm perfect. And I have learned how to think, well, that's a different way to do things. I will let him do that his way. I can learn from that. Because as we all know, addicts love change. We all love change. Love that. That was another great thing I learned in a meeting. I learned that addicts hate change. And when I learned that, I was okay with change. Because if I have to think, oh, there's a change, I'm going to hate it, okay, let's go forward. Adapt and adjust, adapt and adjust. But I had to go to meetings to find out. I had to go to find that out. I'm talking way too long. Just looked at the clock. Are you sure? Okay. Wow, all right. But I sat in meetings and I learned how to not stand by the buffet table. They would say, I'd go through the buffet and I would sit down, I'd get a buffet, and I'm like, well, that's a concept, because I would always just stand at the end of the buffet table, because then people would come by and then we'd talk. You know, I could know people because we talk about the food and stuff, but I had to go away, and then I would look around the room. These were like different business and functions I had to go to, and I would find someone that looked even more uncomfortable than me, and I would go talk to that person. So I was of service that way, and I learned to just connect and get my back away from the food and not to go to very many buffets, because that leftovers was just a concept. I read in some literature, and it talked about leave a bite of food. And I'm thinking, okay, someday I'll be able to do that. Not working on it right now, because it's my food and it's on my plate. But I remember the first day I left food on my plate, and I'm thinking, World Herald, hello, got a story for you, right here, get a picture. And now I learned that I wasn't the only one that didn't ever feel full. They say, well, just eat till you're full. And I'm like, I don't get full. I packed the full switch. And now I'm full. And I remember the stopping at a meal and going, I'm just full, I don't want anymore. You know, archangels, we've got to be somewhere on this one. And I just, excuse me, and I just learned from sitting in meetings. And people, this lady became my sponsor later on, she talked about that the obsession with food had been lifted. She didn't think about food all the time. And I was pretty new. And I sat there and I literally just remember just staring at her. And I'm thinking, I know she's not a liar, but I really don't comprehend that. But I'm just going to trust that that's going to happen to me. And people would sit in meetings and they talk about stuff, and you know, and I just didn't get it. And I just kept coming back. And then pretty soon, I just equate it to like a really big jigsaw puzzle. And every time you come to a meeting, they give you one piece of the puzzle. Now, you don't know what the picture looks like. You just get one piece of the puzzle. And then if you never go back, you just got this one meaningless puzzle piece. But if you just keep going back, you know, you have the little puzzles all over, and then pretty soon it starts forming stuff. And then it starts making sense, and then it starts getting easier. But every day, some way, shape, or form, you get one more piece. And it's like it's a daily reprieve, because I used to think, the other thing, oh, this is great. You know, Calvin and Hobbes. And someday I'm Calvin, and someday I'm Hobbes. And there's this cartoon of them taking the wagon up to the top of the hill, and it was hard pushing the wagon, and Calvin said, like, halfway up, he went, I'm tired, let's just ride down. So they go, whee! And they go, boom! And they look at each other and go, now what? And I'd realize that's what I'd done with my recovery. I would get bored with pushing it up the hill, and so I would just, like, give up, go barreling down, smack into the tree, and then I'm at the freaking bottom again. So now I got to get in, I got to do all the hard work again back up. So now what I learned in program is, okay, if I get tired and it's really a struggle, I might pull over for a while, and then one of you guys is going to come along, and we'll chat for a while, and then I'll get my strength back, and then I can keep going up. I can keep going the road of happy destiny. And I used to picture, know what my mood was, but how I pictured my road of happy destiny, because sometimes it was like we were all there, and it was just like a big party, and we're taking this great walk, like at Platte River or something. We had this great walk, and some days it was rainy, and I was like a Smurf in hip waders, just going, you know, that was a suck walk. That was a bad day, and I'm thinking, all I'm doing is trudging. I'm just getting some trudging in because I'm not seeing any happy destiny. But I just trusted from what people said in meetings that just go forward, just keep going forward. And then I would get to certain issues in my life, and I think, I've dealt with this before. And God says, another layer of the onion. You got to do some more digging. Because I was kind of all or nothing, another addict characteristic, and I would want to box all my issues up and put a bow on it and put it in the shelf and be done with them. Or I'd also want merit badges, like when I do something good, I want a Girl Scout sash, you know, and then here's all my good things I've done. Are you impressed, God? He wasn't. And So then I'd have to do another layer, and there would be, I remember sitting, another great spiritual thing, I sat at a Saturday, Super Saturday, it used to be called Happy-Thons, it's a whole other subject, and this preacher was talking about how he got out of, when he'd get to certain walls of recovery, he just couldn't get past that, and he'd go into relapse again, and how he described it, this is what my brain saw, I was going to a wall, and all of a sudden, I was like a caterpillar or a four-wheel drive, and I just, like, dig the hole deeper. Instead of, like, asking for help or doing anything, I just dig it. And then every time I'd get to that wall, I had a deeper hole to get out of. And you guys can all figure this out in your own brain, because you'll see it different than what I'm saying. But, and so finally, I thought, I'll just get to the wall, and I'll just stop. And then when you guys get there, right, when we're all there at the wall, we'll get us over. We will make a chain, and we will go up, and then we'll reach down, and we'll get everybody over. So that's when I quit being me with this recovery, because it's like, okay, if I'm supposed to deal with this right now, I won't run away from it. I don't know what to do with it, but I'm just going to sit in it for a while, and somebody will say something in a meeting that'll click. And just sitting, first I didn't have them for many years, and then I just had to sit with them, and I'd say, okay, so I have this feeling, so what do I do with them? Well, just sit in it, honey. And then I had two or three at the same time. That was really difficult, really difficult. And so then I just kept coming back, and I just kept coming back, and I just kept coming back. And I'm never going to be good enough. I'm never going to have the ultimate. I'm never going to have all the answers, because there'll always be different questions. But I'm just going to keep coming back. And I know some people that have come for a long time, and they've kind of quit, and they've done some other stuff, and it's like, I probably could. I could probably really go a really long time without going to meetings. I don't want to find out how long. I don't want to find out anything else. I just want to keep coming back. Because sometime I'm going to need what you guys are saying. And really, I'm shutting up now. Don't you want to say?
We'll do question and answer. So now open the meeting to question and we're just speaking. So one of your questions or the speaker share and work the steps or you can get tools. We ask that you raise your hand and wait to ask your question until we're called on.
Talked a lot about God, and you have a relationship with the higher powers. I wonder if you could share a little bit about what your journey was like, if you were like you said, I didn't have a problem with step two, I got mm-hmm. that I was insane, but could you share a little bit more of that journey?
Okay. The question is share about my journey with spirituality. I was a South Dakota Lutheran, so we're pretty standard basic religion, but I had a horrid conflict initially because I had a grandmother who was, well, do good works, but you're going to go to hell anyway because you're never good enough. And my father was always do the right thing no matter what. Literally would get people out of the gutter. Literally saw him give his coat to a guy in the gutter. And I was telling my sponsor this, and she said, there's a huge difference between church and spirituality. And that helped me a lot because I was never good enough for God before. A little side story was these ladies went to a little meeting in a house, and they all, she said, describe your God. And the ladies all wrote down something, and they passed the sheet to this lady, and she looked at all of them. She mixed them up, and she looked at all of them. She gave each it back to everybody. And they said, oh, our handwriting? And she goes, no. Y'all just described yourself. I used to have a very angry, judging, demanding God, and I don't anymore. Now he's kind of like, it's different. So when I was able to allow the love of my higher power in, then I wanted more of him, because he wasn't going to blindside me with bad. I mean, I feel bad if I do bad things, but now I don't beat myself. I learn from them and go forward. That was part of my spirituality, is like, what can you do better? Not how, what you did bad. That kind of answer it? Okay. Yes.
You talked about being afraid of finding out who you were, mm-hmm. who are. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Kind of, sort of, but not really. The question is how the finding out that I used to be afraid of what was in deep inside. We all think we're the worst, you know, the worst piece of crap the world revolves around type of thing. And I don't know if I can describe it. It's just literally a feeling thing, because I was just afraid. There was like this brick wall in the middle of my soul, like the Great Wall of China, and they would talk about things and, you know, different aspects of my life, but like, and they'd say, how do you feel? And I'm thinking, I don't know, and I'm afraid to find out how I feel because I'm afraid it will all be bad feelings. And then I just, and then as I kind of went down this wall, it's a real visual thing. As I went down this wall, I found there was a door. So I kind of like started peeking in the door at me, and then I got comfortable and opened, and it wasn't like this big black, horrid, my pretty kind of thing in there. And I thought that really that's how bad I was in the center of my being. You know, I thought my selfishness, my self-centered was the core of my being. It's the core of my addiction, but it's not the core of my being. I mean, I can be a total poop, but I actually can be pretty nice. I generally go toward being nice rather than being rotten, usually. So, that kind of? Okay. You know, and since most of my life I've been a liar and a thief, you know, I thought that was it. Anything else?
I'm interested to know, you talked about, like, when you were revealing things to your sponsor and to your therapist.
Mm-hmm.
I identify a lot with feeling like a liar. I know I've been a liar and a thief, and mm-hmm. even today I lie and probably thief, or at least inspire in my head to thief. And that against nearby, you were saying also that you would be just going to these meetings, and what you didn't get, you would just act as if, and I love that concept. Can you talk about how you dealt with trying to keep acting as if and working on the problems of being a liar and a thief, or did it just go away?
Working on the issues of being a liar and a thief and acting as if. What would happen when I would, the dishonesty, because I kind of quit stealing the real big stuff in life, the dishonesty slowly faded away because it doesn't fit anymore. I didn't want to feel bad anymore. And when I would lie, one thing, the lies were getting so bad, I couldn't keep them straight. And it was like, well, I need to quit lying because I can't even remember my own lies anymore. So I thought, let's just go with the truth and then I'll remember it. And sometimes the truth was better anyway. I mean, the truth was better. So it's like, first in the part of my mind, it would be like, well, that was a lie. Oh, crap. That makes me feel bad. I don't want to feel bad. Let's do something different next time. And the acting was if I'd get in a situation I didn't know what to do, I'd go, well, what does like a functioning, what would a normal functioning adult do here? And I'd have to guess, you know. I'd go, well, let's be a big girl today. I mean, I had a big girl job, but I'd have to still like guess at appropriate, mature actions. And I'm like over 25. I was 28 when I got in Al-Anon, I was 30 when I got in OA. And sometimes I think, well, I just would have matured. And I'm like, no, pretty much didn't hit until 30. You know, so don't think I would have got away. And so I wasn't just modeling other people's behavior. I was able to watch other people's behavior without judging it. And I'm like, that's a good thing. I want to do what she does. So I would kind of model behavior. And I'd ask my sponsor, it was like, this right? Is this a good thing? And she would nail me periodically with what I thought was reality, and yeah, she's mean. I think I did really good on something, and then she would say how horridly judgmental and self-righteous I had been. Yeah, so those whole loving, nurturing sponsors people talk about, I apparently didn't get one. And, well, they also, what I would do is I wanted her approval, I wanted my sponsor's approval, and I thought if I could lie, because I lied, one of the reasons my first sponsor fired me is because I lied, another person I lied to all the time. And I thought if I get her approval, if she gave me a stamp, then I was good, and I would win. And I wanted the exact rules in this program. And I used to think, I'd just look at people, and I'd be figuring out the rules of this stuff. And all of a sudden, I realized that because I wanted the rules, because if I knew the exact rules, I could cheat, and then I'd win. And I thought, oh, there's no rules. There's just you and God. You can't break you. I had to break me to get me, but yeah, so that was it. It was just kept coming back. And then when I had got the massive amounts of sugar and, you know, quit being bulimic, that was a big help in a lot of ways. It's kind of like if you got a headache, quit slamming your head against the wall, and that headache will go away a lot of times. Yeah. Yes?
I was wondering, could you talk a little bit about what your step work looks like today, like having been in it for 25 years? Like, do you keep going through like 1 through 12, or do you kind of go like the 10, 11, 12? Like, what's your step work generally
it's,
look like?
It's, what does my step work look like? Like an attention deficit dyslexic step work thing. You know? It's like I don't consciously focus on like I'm doing step one. I'll do something and I go, that needs, well, I guess I'm trying to manage this and it doesn't work. I might manage stuff that, write a list of stuff I might manage that I'm trying to manage, or it's like, oh, it's just crazy. Well, that must be a step two. So, but I don't, and then I'll just like read the step, but I don't ever just like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 12. I might like take the 12 and 12 notebook. I'm a terrible journaler. I'm worst at journaling. let's put that another way. I am not prolific in the writing aspect of this program, so that is not my forte. But so a lot of the questions in the notebook still have never been written in, but I just look at the question and kind of like go over that in my head, kind of like what's changed and kind of a gauge on if I'm getting better or I'm still not comfortable with some of those questions. Is that? Mm-hmm. Yeah. And a lot of my step work is with people that I sponsor, because if they're having an issue and I have to talk to them about a step, it always helps me. Always. It's like, I guess I was supposed to say that to them so I'd hear it. Anything else? Yes.
I really related to, and I'm happening to me right now, I'm going to, when you talked about the revisiting the same things coming up over and over and over again, and how you're peeling back layers of onion. I want to know how you deal with that without getting discouraged, or I don't know, how do you, like, particularly, like, I don't know, not necessarily a character defect, but maybe just some aspect of your recovery life, or maybe a personal issue or a family issue that, like, rear its head again, and you thought you dealt with it, but it'll come back, and how do you...
I had to bring up the family part of that, too. How do I deal with stuff that I think I have dealt with and then it comes back again? One of the issues is when I go to South Dakota, I am the baby of the family. My mother's 87, has had a stroke, and she's in a chair. And she will periodically treat me like I'm 13. And you need to get that corner better. And I'm like, I'm scrubbing the floor. And I'm like, Mom, I got bad knees. I'm 57 years old. I'm not getting in that corner anymore. And my mother and I will clash so much on stuff. And then I'll get mad and I'll get defensive. And it's like, stop. This is not the way program people react. So it's like, the issue is still there, but I just react to it better. And sometimes if there's something that'll happen in life that just really still sparks like a spark plug, it's so just uncomfortable or so comfortable, I attempt to, and this might make sense, so it's just me, I will attempt just to let it go. It's like, I'll just figure out where that issue came from some of the time. And I remember driving down Happy Hollow one day, and all of a sudden, that's why that upsets me so much. That, because this thing that happened 20 years ago that I never dealt with 20 years ago, but I keep getting blindsided with it. So it's like, okay, well, I'm not 20 years old now. I can deal with it now. Does that kind of make sense? Yeah, because it's like sometimes I had to figure out where this came from. I didn't have to, because if you try to figure out where it came from first, you may never, you just have to just go, I trust that that will be revealed. More will be revealed. And I stand at the turning point. Am I going to keep going with this? Because it's not up to me to figure it out. It's up to me to let it go. And then, oh, yeah. Because around with my mom, it's just like, I don't like being told what to do. She's 87. She's your mother. Just do what you're told. And then, my dad says I'm like my mom. And my mom says I'm like my dad. And I really am like both of them. And it's like, you guys don't know what a good thing that is in some ways, because they have some phenomenal qualities. But it's like, I have to just accept that that's the potential. I have the potential of being a really controlling, fearful, manipulative person like my mother. Or I can just go, that is in me, but I do not have to react to that today. And my father will stuff any and all feelings. That's a really big tendency of mine. I see what it looks like. I don't want to look like that. So it's just little tiny things. And then in 10 years from now, you're going to look back at this horrid, horrendous pain that you're going through and go, what was the big deal over that? There's been so many things that when I do journal, I'm like, what was the big deal? It seemed like a little painful back then. You know, but it's like, and then I hear people say things like this, and I'm like, I will not die going through this. I will just let go a little bit at a time. That's it? Good? Okay. Anything else?
Well, we can open the meeting to share.